Here on FM, we continue our new Book of the Week. Written and read by Val McDermott, Forensics, the Anatomy of Crime explores the history and development of forensic science. Today, how experts in the fields of entomology and pathology provide vital information to criminal investigations.
Our desire to understand how the dead meet their fate isn't a recent phenomenon. More than 750 years ago, in 1247, a handbook for coroners called The Washing Away of Wrongs was produced by a Chinese official named Sung Tsa. It contained the first recorded example of forensic entomology, the use of insect biology in the solution of a crime. The victim had been stabbed to death by a roadside. The coroner examined the slashes on the man's body, then concluded that the murder weapon was a sickle. Then he turned to possible motives. The best lead was the revelation that the victim hadn't been able to satisfy a man who'd recently demanded the repayment of a debt. The moneylender denied the murder was anything to do with him, but the coroner ordered all 70 adults in the neighbourhood to stand in a line, their sickles at their feet. There were no visible traces of blood on any of the sickles, but within seconds, a fly landed enthusiastically on the moneylender's blade, attracted by minute traces of blood. A second fly followed, then another. When confronted again by the coroner, the moneylender knocked his head on the floor and gave a full confession. He'd tried to clean his blade, but his attempt to conceal his crime had been foiled by the insect informers humming quietly at his feet. When forensic pathologists examine a corpse, they first try to estimate the time of death from phenomena such as rigor mortis, changes in body temperature, and organ decomposition. After about 48 to 72 hours, these clocks have run down. But the time sequences provided by the insects arriving at the scene tick over long after that. Because different insects don't all turn up at the buffet together, there's a predictable order to their arrival. When the entomologists are called in, they use their knowledge of this succession to estimate time of death. Martin Hall of the Natural History Museum juggles his day job with the role of forensic entomologist. At any time, his mobile phone might ping with a police request to drop everything and rush to a crime scene. Martin has devoted much of his life to blowflies, the family of insects most commonly associated with corpses. At the crime scene, he looks for maggots throughout the corpse and for pupae under the soil. He wants to find the oldest specimens because they reveal when the flies first found the corpse and so indicate the point where the person was definitely dead. Martin kills some of those maggots in boiling water and stores them in ethanol. He keeps others alive. Maggots grow faster the warmer it is, so Martin logs the temperature on the hour every hour for the next 10 days. He also gets readings for the past couple of weeks from the weather station closest to the scene, so he knows roughly how hot the maggots were as they grew. Back at the lab, Martin makes the crucial identification of the preserved maggots. Even closely related species develop at different rates, so if you get it wrong, you can be giving the police wrong information. He incubates the live maggots until they become flies, as confirmation of his identification. He examines the anatomy of the preserved maggots carefully to assess their stage of growth. Combining his assessment with the temperature data, he plots a graph leading back in time to the point when the mother blowfly laid her eggs. This is usually a key piece of information and an entomologist's most valuable offering to the forensic puzzle. In the bedrooms, alleyways and beaches that the police call him to, Martin Hall encounters the strange music of hordes of flies. He sees sights and smells of undeniable variety. Entomologists turning to forensics enter an emotionally and intellectually complicated place, but in the end, the discipline is based on one grisly fact. A corpse makes a good lunch. Pathology. Throughout human history, people have wanted to understand why those they care about have died. The very word autopsy derives from the ancient Greek for seeing for oneself. An autopsy is a medical attempt to satisfy that profound curiosity. The first known forensic autopsy took place in 44 BC, when Julius Caesar's doctor reported that of the emperor's 23 stab wounds, only the one between his first and second ribs was fatal. As our understanding of the workings of the human body grew, so did the discipline. In the 16th century, Andreas Vesalius published his landmark book on anatomy, De Humani Corporis Fabrica, on the fabric of the human body, paving the way for modern pathology, the science of disease. French barber surgeon Ambroise Paré, sometimes called the father of forensic pathology, wrote about the effects of violent death on internal organs, explained the indications of death by lightning, drowning, smothering, poison, apoplexy, and infanticide, and showed how to distinguish between wounds made on a living and a dead body. In the 19th century, Alfred Swayne Taylor modernised the discipline in Britain and abroad. His most important textbook, A Manual of Medical Jurisprudence, from 1831, went through 10 editions in his lifetime. Given the theatrical nature of the adversarial English court system, what the discipline needed was someone whose ability came with a liberal sprinkling of charisma. That touch of glamour arrived in the person of Bernard Spilsbury. A handsome, convincing orator, Spilsbury was never seen in public without a top hat, tails, buttonhole and spats. Juries and the public loved Spilsbury. The first time he came to their attention was in 1910, as an expert witness at the sensational trial of Dr. Hawley Harvey Crippen. An American homeopath and patent medicine salesman, Crippen had been living in Camden Town with his wife Cora, a music hall singer with the stage name Belle Elmore. The marriage had been in difficulties. Then Cora's friends suddenly stopped seeing her around. Dr. Crippen told them variously that she had died and that she had gone to America to further her career. The police questioned Crippen and searched his house. They found nothing. But the investigation panicked Crippen, who fled with his teenage mistress, Ethel Leneve, aboard the SS Montrose, bound for Canada. Leneve dressed as a boy and posed improbably as his son. The flight rekindled the suspicions of the police, who mounted a second and then a third search of Crippen's house, in which they dug up the brick floor of the cellar. This time, they found what were believed to be the remains of a human torso, wrapped in a man's pyjama top. The police called in a surgeon from St Mary's Hospital, London, to examine the body, and he put the young Spilsbury on the case. Spilsbury took a close look at Cora Crippen's medical records and noticed that she'd had an operation on her abdomen. The autopsy did not reveal the sex of the body, but Spilsbury did find traces of toxic compounds. At Crippen's trial, Spilsbury presented a piece of skin bearing a curved scar, preserved in formaldehyde, from the torso believed to belong to Cora Crippen. He passed it round the jury in a glass dish. Although the defence pathologist argued that because it had hair follicles growing from it, it must be folded skin and not scar tissue, the jury believed Spilsbury. Crippen was found guilty of drugging and murdering his wife. He was hanged at Pentonville Prison in London, and at his request, buried with a photograph of Leneve. She was charged and then acquitted of being an accessory after the fact. The Crippen slides still exist in the Royal London Hospital, and in 2002 Professor Bernard Knight examined them. He could not see definite indications of scar tissue. Recent DNA testing of the fragments seemed to show that the DNA does not match that of some of Cora Crippen's descendants, and that the remains are male. Ironically, it seems that the case which projected Spilsbury into the public consciousness as the standard bearer for forensic pathology may have been one in which he was comprehensively mistaken. New technology is letting pathologists see deeper than ever before into a human subject without the need to roll their sleeves up. The virtual autopsy, or VA table, is a new medical visualisation tool built in Switzerland that combines CT and MRI scans to transform images of a dead body into a 3D computer model. Pathologists using it in Germany have found fractures and hemorrhages undiscoverable using conventional autopsies. The VA table also includes a high-resolution scanner, which means the skin can be magnified to better reveal things like bruising or malicious injection points. It also causes less distress to the living, who don't want to contemplate what they see as the desecration of the bodies of their loved ones. Dick Shepherd, a leading forensic pathologist in the UK, says, "I have to separate myself from the destructive things that I do and remember that I'm doing it for the families of the dead. It doesn't help them in any practical way, but if there are points of truth they can fix on them and achieve closure." Toxicology. Poison is one of the oldest weapons humans have used against each other. As science advanced, the job of the toxicologist developed to identify lethal substances and search for antidotes. When English chemist James Marsh published the details of his extremely sensitive test for arsenic in 1836, the Pharmaceutical Journal of London enthused, "The dead are now become the witnesses whom poisoners have most to fear." But the Marsh test did not deter all would-be killers. In 1832, Mary Ann Cotton was born in a village near Durham in the northeast of England. When she was 19, Mary Ann fell pregnant to a miner called William Mowbray, and together they travelled the country looking for work. Mary Ann gave birth to 5 children during this nomadic period, but 4 of them died, possibly from natural causes. In 1856, the couple moved back up north, where Mary Ann had 3 more children by Mowbray, all of whom died of diarrhoea. But her grief didn't prevent her from claiming on the life insurance policies she'd taken out on all 3 of them. Then Mowbray injured his foot in a pit accident and had to convalesce at home. Soon he became ill and was diagnosed with gastric fever and died in January 1865. Mary Ann went down to the office of the Prudential Insurance Company and collected the £30 policy which she'd recently encouraged Mowbray to take out. In 1872, Mary Ann took her 7-year-old stepson Charles Cotton to the local workhouse. When the superintendent refused him entry, Mary Ann told him that the boy was sickly, and if the superintendent didn't change his mind, he would soon die, like all the other Cottons. All other options having failed, she poisoned Charles. The workhouse superintendent heard about his sudden demise and went to the police. The doctor who had attended Charles before he died carried out an autopsy and found no evidence of poison, so the coroner ruled death by natural causes. But the doctor had kept Charles's stomach and intestines, and when he subsequently tested them, he discovered the lethal poison. The bodies of Mary Ann's most recent victims were exhumed and found to contain high levels of arsenic. Her defence lawyer argued that Charles had inhaled arsenic fumes from green paint on the wallpaper of his room. But under the weight of the evidence from the exhumed bodies and other witness statements, Mary Ann was found guilty of murder and sentenced to death. It seemed extraordinary now that no one suspected her, but until she poisoned Charles, she had been too careful, clever and charming, changing her name and moving house too often to be found out. Mary Ann became the most prolific female serial killer in British history. Although it will never be known exactly how many people she poisoned with arsenic, she likely murdered her mother, 3 of her 4 husbands. The other one refused to take out a life insurance policy. A lover, 8 of her 12 children and 7 stepchildren. At least 20 people in total. Once she was hanged, her notoriety was guaranteed. The story ran in the newspapers for months and a broadsheet rhyme was coined. Mary Ann Cotton, she's dead and she's rotten.
Val McDermid was reading Forensics, The Anatomy of Crime. It was abridged by Sian Preece and produced by Allegra McElroy. Coming up after the news, the auction of the Woman's Hour cooker.
Rufus Wainwright talks to BBC Radio 4.
A lot of the songs were written when I was very screwed up.
As he looks back to his breakthrough album, Want One.
No matter how strong.
But I was in a bit of a tornado with drugs and alcohol, and beyond making records, I just didn't want to die. I'm gonna.
In concert and in conversation, John Wilson presents Master Tapes with Rufus Wainwright. You can hear the programme now on the BBC Radio 4 website.